to CHRW 94.9 show Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. My name's Michelle Boyce, and I'm running solo in the studio today. Kim's got an exam, and DJ's not available, so we're going to push buttons and run the show all single-handedly, so hopefully this goes exactly how it's supposed to on a radio station. So we're a show about human rights, and we're a show about people's pursuit of happily ever after. And sometimes, you know, we have a show about people's pursuit of happily ever after and human rights. And that's what we have a show for you about today. We have an incident that is happening up in the small town of Napanee, Ontario, where there's a group home that is providing superior care to some people that really need you to reach out and help them along the way. And we're talking about people that have, you know, disabilities and mental health issues. And, you know, they just need a helping hand. And on the line, I have a wonderful, wonderful woman who is doing exactly that up there, Kendra O'Brien. Kendra, are you there?
I am. Thanks.
Wonderful.
For having me.
We can just barely hear you, but can you speak up
a
little bit?
Speak a little louder, sure.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks. And so can you give everybody, first off, give them a background of what do you do up there?
Well, what we do is, I'll start it with what I used to do. I was a mental health nurse, and my job was to take people from the hospital and take them back into the community and transition them. These were patients from a mental health facility. So I would be out taking them, setting them up in group homes, and basically just getting them back out into the real world again. And in my course of doing that, I saw a lot of really substandard group homes. I saw some group homes that really worked, and I saw a lot of group homes that were really disgusting, really. And I stopped one day and I thought to myself, if I ever had a mental illness, if I ever was in an accident and had a brain injury, would I ever survive in a place like this? You know, clearly there wasn't much hope for people. They were always in a bad neighborhood. There was a lot of crime. The meals were terrible. They were quite dark and dingy. And I just thought, no one can recover in a place like that. So I decided that I would take the good that I learned and the bad and retire and start my own group home, which is what we did. And we kind of had this vision that the group home should not be in the lower end of town. It should be where everyone else wants to live. So we set out to find a home that was close to the hospitals, close to the pharmacy, you know, close to the dentist, in a really nice, safe neighborhood, close to some parks. And this is where we bought the house. And it was in a really nice area town. And what happened was, after we bought the house and got the house going, we met with a lot of negative resistance, both from the neighborhood and from the town council and its mayor.
Yeah. So let's talk about the way mental health is provided care, because you brought up a good point, and I do a lot of work in this area myself when I'm not on the air. And, you know, I've been in all of the facilities, and I've rescued people from all of the facilities, you know, and, you know, if you walk into, especially some of this institutionalized care, I mean, you walk in and you think this facility was built in the 50s. It hasn't been upgraded at all.
Exactly.
You know you're in a warehouse.
Yes.
Right? It's just a warehouse for people.
Yes. And in order to get better from a mental health illness, I mean, it's important for someone's recovery to have hope, to have dreams, to have goals, which is very difficult to have hope and be happy and not depressed when you're, you know, in a congregate living situation where there's, you know, maybe 20, 30 people you're living with. You know, the conditions are not ideal. You may, you know, you don't even know who you're living in the house with most of the time.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's not a place to recover.
No.
And then when we talk about some of these group homes and the conditions that we see in them, I mean, some of them are fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there, you know, in my small town of Elmer, Ontario, I know that there is a fantastic little group home there, very similar to the one that you run, which really attracted me to this story is because I have seen a community positively act around one of these situations and one of these homes and have seen a community come together with the occupants of the home and build a better community. So I've seen the other shoe on this coin and you know, they do a great job and you know, everybody there has a home.
Yeah.
And I mean, when we talk about housing first, I mean, the research is very clear that, you know, it all starts with a home.
Exactly. I mean, it's all about being a home, being a family, especially for our group home. I don't even like to call it a group home. We see it as a foster home for adults. If you came down our street, you wouldn't know that our house was a group home. If you came in the door, you would have no idea that it's just not a home like any other home. You know, our kids are here. We have grandchildren here. It looks identical to every other home, and we all act as a family together because a lot of the people that we service are individuals who have always lived at home with their parents. These parents now are elderly. They've either passed away or they've gone into nursing homes. There was no place or no plans made because they didn't want to think about that was going to happen. And then when it did, all of a sudden, there's no place for these people to go. So we actually, at one time, have had 5 individuals who found themselves in that situation, found themselves homeless because their parents had died or their parents, you know, got dementia and just couldn't care for them any longer. So when we opened the home, we decided it was going to be a family home first. That meant you know, there's going to be kids, there's going to be dogs, there's going to be people here. We're all going to eat together. We're all going to go out together. We're, you know, they're going to eat the same food that we're eating as opposed to some group homes where they bring the food in, you know, staff are there. It's nothing like a home. This is a family first. So we act like every other family does. It's just that we have 7 exceptional people that live with us.
And so how long have you been operating?
18 months.
Okay, so this isn't new.
No.
18.
And this is home to these people. Clearly when reporters have come in and interviewed them, they ask them questions like, what is this place to you? And they all say home. What are these people to you? What are Kendra and Brian to you? And they'll say, they're like my mom and dad. They're like my family. It's an incredible project, really. Certainly it started with a dream and it's just developed into everything we wanted it to be.
Okay, so 18 months ago you had a dream and you brought it to fulfillment and I mean, I've seen the pictures of your home and it's absolutely beautiful and well kept and very nice, and I would love to live there.
That's what everyone says when they come here. It's like, can I stay? We had a new client come in. He's been here for less than a month, and they brought him in the first day just to tour the place, and he didn't even want to leave. He just said, he said to his worker, well, you can just go and get my stuff and, you know, and bring it to me. He clearly, you know, and he said, save that room. I want that room. Don't let anyone take that room. And then he looks at me and he goes, because I want to live in a mansion.
Aw, that's so sweet.
And when people ask him where he lives, he'll say, I live in the mansion. Because this is a mansion compared to any other place he's lived. He has lived in some really deplorable conditions. And he now goes out on the back deck and plays his guitar and sits in his room and plays his guitar. He'll come out the kitchen and play his guitar for us. He walks to the store just about every day. And he'll just go down and get a bag of chips and a Diet Pop and walk back home. And he's not used to having that. Where, you know, where he lived before, he wouldn't, you know, barely go out on the street because he'd get robbed, he'd get mugged, he'd get beat up.
Yeah, and that's not okay.
No.
And, you know, none of us want to live in that kind of environment. And you know, we do the work here. And, you know, our first thing is to set up people in a secure home that they can feel safe.
Exactly.
You know, and when you have these triggers and you have, you know, all of the stressors and anxiety that society has put on you through the years, you know, that's the very first thing that you need before you can heal, is you need security.
Yeah.
And you know, you're providing that. And, okay, so that's the good side. We have a wonderful place that you know, is a wonderful home for people. And so who has an issue with you?
Well, it started out with the neighbors, of course. They had a big issue when they found out that we had mental health clients living in their neighborhood. And they started taunting the residents, calling them names. Residents would be sitting outside and they'd come in and they'd be crying and they wouldn't want to go back out front. And I'd say, you know, what's the problem? And they're like, oh, people are calling us names. They're calling us retards. You know, they're calling us this and that. We had an incident where a couple of them went to a yard sale and they wanted to buy some hot dogs. Somebody was barbecuing hot dogs and they were told to go home. I won't say what they were called, but they were told to go home from this yard sale, and they refused the hot dogs. It's just been really hateful. The neighbors have made up a lot of stories about them looking at their children, being pedophiles, that they're hanging out in the family park. It's just ridiculousness. Any possible negative thing that can be said is being said in hopes that we will just buckle to the pressure and just move somewhere else.
And
but this is home to us. This is our neighborhood too.
Well, and there's a lesson there, right? Because if you run every time the times get tough.
That's right.
I mean,
someone has to be the voice.
Exactly. And you know, it's, how many times have we heard all of these exact same stories? I mean, you know, pedophilia. I mean, how many times has a gay person been called a pedophile, you know, when there's no connection whatsoever?
Yeah.
You know, for some reason, as soon as society gets their back up and they don't understand something, all of a sudden, pedophilia has to come into play.
That's right.
I mean, I'm not sure why that is. We should do a research study on that one.
Well, I think it's because it's such an ugly crime that they just, you know, they just are trying to vilify everyone. But when you go to our Facebook page, like Abidon Place, you can clearly see pictures of the residents interacting with, you know, my daughter. So it's kind of ridiculous that other people are worried that they're looking at their daughter when my daughter is in the house. She's running the house. I hate to say this, but everybody thinks they're... their children are beautiful, but I mean, she's a beautiful looking girl. I just can't see that they're going to run out of our house to go and grab someone else's child. My grandchild was living here for quite some time with us and her. And there's clearly pictures on the website of him interacting with the clients. He'd go to the family park with them. You know, it's just, it makes no sense to actually even say these things when you can look at these pictures and they speak a thousand words. You know, you see the clients interacting. You see them laughing with the child. You see the child laughing. You can see there's clearly no evidence that these people are harmful to children. It's sad, really. It's really sad that they've vilified them like that.
It's no different than... I mean, I work with a lot of marginalized people. I work within mental health itself. I work within the LGBT communities. And, you know, and everybody tries to keep their kids away from my clients.
Yeah.
And, you know, my daughter's in, actually in studio with me right now, summer break and all. So she's 14, and you know, never have I ever had a concern about her coming out with me and working with me and you know, interacting with my clients and friends. And it really irks me when people start hiding their kids from really, really nice people.
Yeah, like our children and grandchild, they love our clients, and our clients love them, and that's very clear. Again, when you go on the website and look at the pictures, it's very clear that they very much are like family. It's just like my daughter and son have, you know, a few more older brothers who just happen to look a little bit different, but they certainly, in the house, everyone is treated equal, and we treat everyone, you know, like they are our family. And that's what makes this project work. This is what sets this group home apart from a lot of others. One, the fact that I used to be a nurse, so I have a lot of mental health background, a lot of nursing background. My husband was a special education teacher for 25 years. He worked with developmentally delayed students. So combined, we've got a lot of experience working with people. And our children have grown up, too, with the attitude that we have, that no one is different. You look a little different on the outside, but on the inside, you know, we're all the same.
And that's pretty much a message that you can take home. So, okay, so your neighbors started complaining.
Yeah.
And who else? Because you've got a lot more than just your neighbors stacked up against you.
Well, it started out with the neighbors, and then there was a support group that was started. And they had shown up at the house one day. I had no idea that they were coming. I didn't even realize that they had there was a support group. But my husband saw them, and he said, "There's a group of people gathered out front of the house." And I thought, "Oh no, like oh no." I said, "Go and see what they want." So he went out, and he said, "They're supporters." So I went out and spoke to them, and I said, "You know, come on in the house, because if you stand out front of the house very long, surely somebody's going to come up to you." And they were like, no, it's okay, it's okay. Interestingly enough, though, they brought a reporter with them. So I was kind of a little bit, you know, wondering, why have they showed up with a reporter and you know, nobody's told me that they're even coming. But they weren't there very long. I said, "I've got to go and get dressed," because I still was in my pajamas. I said, "I'll be right out." So I came in and got dressed, and by the time I went back out, a neighbor had already been there. They had the gentleman told one of the supporters that he didn't want these misfits in his upper-class community. Luckily, the reporter did have her digital recorder with her, and I looked at her, and I said, "Did you get that?" And she said, "Yes," and she showed me the recorder, and I said, "Well, good." But, you know, they weren't here more than probably 10 minutes when that incident happened. And if that can happen in 10 minutes, you can only imagine all the things that have happened in 18 months. So they, you know, it was really ugly, and sad that people are still, one, holding those kind of attitudes. But clearly we'll walk up to somebody on the street and say, like, "We don't want those misfits." And you really, you know, you look at these people and you think, honestly, like, this is upper class and this is the way you think in 2012. We're not living in the dark ages. So then there was a support group, and it started getting infiltrated by neighbors, and, you know, all kinds of allegations started going out. And because I am the one speaking out, because I am the one standing up for the clients, of course, I am the one that is under scrutiny. So people then started making really wild allegations. One was 2 weeks ago. 3 to 4 weeks ago, one of my female residents was at a yard sale, left unattended for 2 hours, and she got sent home. And I told them, I said, "I don't have a female resident." Like, that was not somebody from from my home. But clearly people don't want to hear the truth. They just want to keep making up these stories and frightening people in the community that, you know, these are pedophiles and these are criminals. And even when I've gone directly to them and given them the truth, they won't take it because they don't want to hear it. They want to find anything. They want to get an audience. They're upset that this town looks bad, that I have made this town look bad. Yet it's really the mayor of this town that made this town look bad. It's the people who are not treating these individuals as individuals. They're wanting to protect these people when these people don't need protection. None of them are incompetent. None of them have been deemed incompetent. And every one of them has a right to decide where they live, with whom they live. And it's not up to the public. It's not up to the people in Napanee to decide where they live. The clients do. The families do. You know, the mayor never does. Certainly if I had a disabled child and I couldn't care for them, I wouldn't be going to the mayor and asking him, you know, where should this child live? I would be making that decision. Or a substitute decision maker would be making the decision, but never would the public, nor should the public expect that they should be part in deciding issues like that. That's an issue for the family.
Absolutely not. And I will tell the listeners that we do have an invitation out to the mayor to join us online with this show. And he has the number to call in and join us and give his side of the story. So they're not sure if he's going to or not, but it's Mayor Gordon Schermerhorn?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have an invite out to him to join us and discuss this issue, and we'll see if he takes us up on that.
Mm-hmm.
We're not holding our breath.
Well, I think the issue is clear, too, that this is a human rights issue. This is an issue that everyone has to be treated equal, regardless if you have a disability, if it's your skin color, if it's your choice of a partner. If you want to buy a house, you should not have to go up and bang on doors and ask people if it's okay to live here. You should be able to, in this day and age, buy a house, move in, and have no questions asked. I know there's a lot of people who are upset because I didn't, you know, go to the public first. But honestly, if you see the reaction that is happening now, the hatred, the slander, the extremes that people are going to get this group home moved, if I'd have gone in the first place, my clients would still be in hospital, because what's happening now would have just happened then, and I knew it.
And
so
it's not up to you.
And it's not their right. It's not the right of the community to know that these people have a mental illness. It's not their right to know what is wrong with them. It is not their right to know where they're getting paid, you know, if they're on a pension or where their funding is coming from. It's just not their right. Now, we have come out and said and been very public. You know, we spoke to the clients. We've told them, like, reporters want to come. They want to interview you. They want to take a picture. They want to put you out there. They want to put, you know, they want people to hear you, not just hear me. They want to hear you. And every one of them has been very supportive of that. They've been on the television, and they'll ask all day after the reporter's been here, like, what time am I going to be on TV? And then I said it'll be 6 o'clock, and at 6 o'clock, or quarter to 6, the kitchen table is full. And they're sitting waiting for themselves to come on TV because they love that people are coming and talking to them and getting their voice out there and personalizing this. Now is the time we've had to personalize it. But before we moved in, we really didn't have to, and it's unfortunate too now that we're even talking about this issue.
So what if, obviously they're trying to get rid of you, and
obviously, and
so what's their tactic? What have they done to you?
Oh, just personal attacks that are just outlandish, you know, just cruel hatred towards me personally. There's a group, and there's 2,000, I believe, 600 on a group that are just trying to find anything they can to, as an excuse to get these people moved out of here, an excuse not to like me, and, you know, they're upset that their community is looking bad, and I'm the person, I'm the bad person that has made their town look bad. But, you know, it was the councillor's decision and the mayor's decision that made them look bad. Their lawyer told them, do not try to prosecute this case. You will lose. He told them, it's against human rights what you're doing. You're not going to be successful. And they chose not to take their lawyer's advice, and they chose to pull our group home license, and now we're in the situation that we're in. And I don't understand why people are angry, because all I am doing is standing up for people who don't have a voice. I'm standing up for the rights of seven people and their right to decide where they want to live. And that is their right.
Yeah, well, you know, this is what happens when you're, and, you know, I'll give you some of my own personal experience, and because I'm at the forefront of a lot of these public campaigns. But, I mean, I just had a festival down in Port Stanley, Ontario, where the municipality pulled our permit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Gay Pride celebration. And 2 weeks prior to the festival, the municipality pulled the permit. So we ended up in a media campaign very similar to the one that you're running, and
mm-hmm.
and I was at the forefront of it, and mm-hmm. as the chair of the committee, I, you know, my face was the one that was on the paper and everything else, and you know, the people that didn't want Pride there, now they're accusing, you know, me of everything from stealing money to who knows what else.
Oh,
out
exactly.
There. You know, I've trampled their children and who knows what else, because that's the way they operate.
Mm-hmm.
You
and
know?
That's all over. And, you know, it's worse in a small town because people are related and it's very cliquey.
Oh, I hear
and,
you.
And it's just,
the festival was in Port Stanley, Ontario, you know, population, you know, 1,000 people.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a small, you know, half retirement community, half tourism community, and, you know, they can't figure out what they are as a community.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the way it goes. And,
yeah.
You know, hats off to you for, you know, standing up to it and, you know, being there for these people when, you know, they need somebody.
Exactly. But they don't need somebody to tell them. You know, people now are, right now, are irate and, you know, saying things like, they need to be protected. They need to be taken out of there because they need to be protected from her, because I've been very vocal on the issue, very vocal that we're not going to move, very vocal when they put information out that is not correct. I'm instantly correcting the information, feeding it back to them. But again, nobody wants to accept the truth, and you can't force someone to accept the truth. All we can do is continue to post pictures on our webpage, continue to let people decide for themselves, continue to let people see our clients and us, and perhaps they'll get the message. What we won't do, though, is, you know, have an open house for the neighbors, because the neighbors have really frightened our clients. They don't like them. They're afraid of them. And this is their safe place. This is their home. So, no, we're not going to have an open house. We're not going to have a public display for the neighbors to come in. I did offer up to this large group of people. I said, you know, if you want to know the facts, what goes on here, I'm putting it out here. Anybody can come and job shadow me for a day. You don't have to clean the toilets. You can watch me clean them or clean the rooms. All you got to do is follow me around for a day. See if you can do this job or you can do it any better than I'm doing it. see the residents, meet them, see how the homes run, see what's here. We've been accused of having a puppy mill and, oh, just ridiculous things. I said, come in and follow me around and see for yourself instead of listening to all this stuff that's being put out there. And you know how many came?
None.
No one came.
Exactly. So
not one person came to job shadow me for a day.
And that's a shame. So, Kendra, we'll be back after these very short messages with more about this story up in Napanee.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters. We can do better. Raise your voices to the sky. The price of silence is much too high.
This is Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. And I have the distinct pleasure of having Kendra O'Brien on the phone, who runs a group home up in Napanee, Ontario. And she is very, 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 very dedicated to these people. And she's running into Not in My Neighborhood, which is, you know, I think it's people getting all upset about property values again. And you know, I'm not buying their argument. I don't know about you. If you want to talk to us, you can call in at 519-661-3600, and we'll put you on the air. Kendra, you there?
I am.
Wonderful. So you know, we've got the background of this story and you know, what you've attempted to do and all of that. And what I have here is there's another program down in the U.S., in Virginia, that is Pathways, that is a homeless first or a homelessness and mental health project and running the housing first model. And, you know, I want the listeners to listen to, you know, another one of these types of programs that is effectively working.
I've seen homelessness develop. People who are 30 years old or younger have grown up believing that homelessness was always part of the landscape, that there were always homeless people on these park benches because that's what they've seen. But before 1980, we didn't have homelessness. So I know there was a time before where there was no homeless. We didn't see people with mental illness on the streets. And I also know, what I find most painful, is that we know how to cure this problem. And it's just a matter of putting the political will and the resources in place to end it. So how will it be in 10 years looking back? Maybe there'll be a homeless museum. And we'll say, oh, here's some photographs of people that they used to sit. They used to sit on benches, but they don't do that anymore.
What?
As a society, the United States has one of the lower recovery rates for schizophrenia. Places like Pakistan and India have higher recovery rates for schizophrenia than we do in the United States. And we also have one of the most overprescribed treatment systems in mental health in the world. You know, Americans are taking more medication than probably any other civilized country. Whereas in other societies, you're getting better outcomes with less medication because there's more social support. There's a different sense of inclusiveness among people with mental illness. Here we have this long history of asylum, and our current solutions still are to create mini asylums. The issue of integrating people with mental illness or tolerating the difference or supporting them amongst ourselves is not as popular as it is in other cultures. And yet, if we look cross-culturally, other cultures are doing a better job of taking care of their mentally ill with less medication and less money. At the end of the first year, our first annual report was we had succeeded in housing and keeping housed 84% of those 50 people. And that number, about 85%, has been the number that's been held up with hundreds of people that followed, not only our programs, but in Denver, in Ohio, in San Francisco, Oakland, Chicago. You know, the program has been manifest in many, many different states now.
And well, it's going to be talk about that, because it started in New York, and
yes.
DIDA's catching on?
It's catching on, yeah. I mean, there were, I would say, a snapshot of the history of it was no way. the reaction to the program. No way. You must be choosing the most well-developed homeless mentally ill people, the ones that you know are barely mentally ill at all. The opposite was true. We were choosing people that had mental illness, that had addiction, that had physical health problems, that had difficult behavior or histories of incarceration. We were targeting the very people that we knew would never make it in any other program. You know, it's like, oh, they have three things wrong? That's great. They have five? Even better. We'll take them. So that was our goal. Our goal was to take people no one else would house. And then people thought, you know, why are you doing this? Or you can't be telling the truth about this data. And then when the data, we did a randomized controlled trial funded by the federal government. I'd be coming down to D.C. walking over homeless people, mentally ill, to present the data about how effective this intervention was. But people said, won't work here. Won't work in Detroit. No, it can't possibly work in Washington. We already are doing that in Delaware. At some point, the shift was an infusion of dollars at the federal government. The Interagency Council coordinated an RFP. The science was there. And they said, you know what, if you want to get any of this $35 million, you'll have to house people within 6 months, and you have to provide wraparound services for doing that. They didn't call it anything. They just said those were the particulars. People reading the thing said, well, we can't build anything. There's not enough time. It's the only way we're going to be able to do this is, like, just put someone in an apartment and then support services. That's what everybody started doing. And it went literally overnight from, you can't do this here, to, could you come over and help us understand how to run this program?
So what do you think, Kendra?
Well, I mean, that's one of the best things I've heard. And certainly that's the model that we work from. The hard to house, the people who have been in multiple group homes before and never have stayed, yet they stay here and they're happy here. We had one guy who left, and he called me up one day, and he said, you have to come and pick me up. And I said, I can't. You're being followed by an agency. You're being followed by an outpatient team. I cannot just walk in and take you out of all those services. And he said, you have to come. And I said, you know, I can't do that. And he said, put your husband on, put Brian on. And I said, he's not here right now. And he said, you have to come and get me. And I said, I'll talk to Brian when he comes home. So Brian came home, and I talked to him, and I said, you know, he's called. He wants us to come and pick him up. He wants to come back here. So then shortly after there, he called again, and I answered the phone, and he said, Kendra, please, I'm in a group home. The cook is drunk. He said, I cannot stay sober here for, you know, I can't stay sober here any longer. And he said, I'm going to start drinking. They're all drinking. I need to leave. I'm going to end up in jail. And I said, okay, I'll have Brian come in the afternoon after lunch. I said, later afternoon. And he said, Kendra, I want to come home. Please, I want to come home. And I said, we'll be there within the hour. Gather your things. We'll be there within the hour. We'll bring you home, and any backlash that happens, we'll deal with it, which we did. And he's happy here. He swims in our pool every day. He plays with a grandchild every day. You know, every day he gets up and mops the floor for me. Say, Kendra, you work so hard. You have so much to do. Please just let me mop the floor. And so he does. Every day he gets up, mops the floor for me. And, you know, it's just like he's never been gone, and he has purpose again. You know, just a little task of mopping the floor is such a huge deal for him. We ran out of window cleaner, which he uses on the hardwood floor, and he was just, can you get the window cleaner? Can you get the window cleaner? I've got to get these floors washed today. And I said, oh, it's okay, you know, one day's fine. He's like, no. He goes, no, I like to do this. I, you know, this is my job here. And I said, you don't have to have a job here. This is your home. This is, you know, you don't work here. And he said, I understand that. But he said, it gives me something to do. It makes me feel better about myself. It keeps my mind occupied. And he said, I'll go to the store and get the window cleaner over at the corner store. And I said, no, I'll send Brian out. But, you know, it's just unbelievable to see how well these people do in this kind of an environment.
Yeah, and, you know, the things that you see, and, you know, you read, I'm sure you've read some of the feedback.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, are on some of these stories.
Hate sites. They're hate sites, really.
Yeah, you know.
It's hatred.
I've got one that, you know, adults with mental disabilities is often code for persons with anger problems, career criminals, addicts, and kleptos. I mean, that's a total and complete lack of education by this individual who is writing these hurtful words.
Exactly. And if they got to know these people, they would love them like we do. You know, they're very special people. And they're so kind, you know, they're so grateful that they're not living in a rundown house anymore, that they can go to bed and be safe. They can actually go to bed and sleep and not think that, oh, I got to stay awake because somebody's going to come in and go looking through my room and steal my cigarettes. Like, I've had clients say that, like, I can actually go and sleep. I know I'm safe. I know nobody's going to break into the house. Because we've got a pretty sophisticated alarm system. And they say, we can go to sleep. We don't have to worry. Somebody's going to come in and steal my cigarettes or steal my DVDs or come in and go through my things, which was normal, you know, when they lived in housing.
Well, I have a story about that kind of thing. And I do a lot of diversity training in a lot of environments. And in one of the places that I regularly, every 6-8 months, am in doing diversity work is one of the youth jails.
Mm-hmm.
And this jail is for 14 to 18 year old women. And so I go in and do various diversity training and work there, and I love it there. But one time I was there and there was a young lady that, you know, she was getting out in 2 days. And you know, she was getting ready to leave jail, and her time was up. And, you know, that was great. And, you know, after the work, they invited me to lunch, and I joined them for lunch and, you know, talked to them and everything else. And then I came back about 8 months later, and she was there. And I'm like, hon, what are you doing here? I know you were going home in 2 days. And she's like, yeah, well, I left here and I bounced from group home to group home and group home. So then I went out and I robbed X so that I could come back here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and mm-hmm. she got sentenced to 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, and this is someone who came to jail for safe space.
Yes. And that's not uncommon. And like I say, if you visit some of the places, you know, I would be depressed after a day if I really got in that room and sat on that bed and looked around at the four walls and thought, this is where I'm going to live now, probably forever. It's not hard to see why people are committing suicide. There is no hope. There's no chance that they're going to be included in society. There's no meaning to their life. It's just a really dark, difficult place for people. And Abidjan Place is the exact opposite of that, and it was meant to be the exact opposite. You know, how many group homes do you go to where they have a pool, you know, where they have, we have a therapy dog program here at our house. And every night the clients walk the dog. That's part of their program because a couple are diabetic. They're overweight because of various side effects from medication. The fact that they don't exercise when they're in an environment where, you know, where they've come from a lot of times. They just lay in their bed because there's nothing else to do. They're depressed. And the therapy dogs, they get them up. They give them a reason to get up. They get out. They walk. They lose weight. They're healthier. And, you know, it's just a whole different life for them. A whole different life for them. And I don't understand why people are not supporting this. However, I'll say, on the other hand, we have a lot of support. We have really our whole country behind us. I have been getting emails and calls from people from all over Canada who are supporting us, who keep saying, keep fighting the fight, keep doing it. You know, keep standing up. Don't let the negativity get to you. You know, don't let people who don't know you hurt you. Don't let them stop you from pursuing your dream, which is helping other people. Keep being the voice. You know, they always shoot the messenger. Just keep doing it. I got up this morning, actually, and my husband came in and he said, I found a note in our door this morning. And he said, I was afraid to open it. He said, I didn't know what it was. He said, I'm not sure. And I opened it, and it was a letter from somebody. And the subject is moral emotional support. And it's a 2-page letter from somebody who is asking to be anonymous. And it's one of the most beautiful letters I've seen. And very, very to the point. He says he's a, I'll just read you a quick,
Hey, why don't you read it to us?
It's 2 pages long.
Oh, well, don't read it all, then.
I'll just read you some of it. Dear Kendra and Brian, I read with considerable interest your story in both the Napanee Beaver and the Guide. My purpose in writing is to offer moral and emotional support to your position in the situation. I'm not accredited professional authority, but have worked at times in the mental health industry, both in psychiatric institutions and residential therapeutic settings. I'm currently networked with numerous psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychotherapists, primarily in the area of residents, patients, rights, and advocacy. As a result of this involvement and research I've undertaken in recent years, I'm conversant with numerous mental health and residents, patients, rights issues. He goes on to say that he obviously doesn't want to be identified because of his position, not because of anything else other than that. He says the central issue, which remains clear, and I'm surprised if you didn't concur, is that the neighborhood within which you are currently established is truly an ideal neighborhood, all things considered, for the provision of such service. I've said ideal for 2 principal reasons. It's ideal from the point of view of residents' benefit, in that this neighborhood represents a fairly conventional and safe residential demographic within which we may have assumed they can grow and feel well-adjusted, without being stigmatized or ostracized, which is clearly often the result of institutional and other settings. Such stigmatization is counterproductive to both their fundamental right to lawful happiness, a right they share in common with local residents. For shame that would taunt the vulnerable, as reported, as well as a wholesome reintegration within the magnificent society. The second reason such location is ideal is because such reintegration is an excellent process and opportunity for local residents, the elderly and children, to be socially exposed to the quality of care recipients you house, whereby they learn to practice embracing these deserving humans, no less deserving than themselves, having special needs. This represents a compassionate opportunity for the local residents to accept and love your residents, and in a neighborhood way that doesn't endanger any form of unconscionable being demonstrated, stigmatization, detrimental to their continued improved well-being. Remarks such as crazy, defected, retarded, dangerous, or a threat are absolutely wrong and non-negotiably unacceptable. In fact, isn't it they who would unconscionably hold such ideas within their minds who are truly the retarded? If there be any trace of such an element within community pressure to have you relocate, the Human Rights Tribunal, to the best of my knowledge, is exactly the venue within which this travesty needs to be aired and addressed. That garnered attention harms the municipality, as claimed by prominent politicians, is 100% balderdash. The truth needs to come out, and politicians should view this as an ideal opportunity for Napanee to redeem itself, not to mention set an example for others. Local politicians and residents understandably are doing some rather furious backpedaling now that the issue has registered provincially, thanks to your astute initiative to release particulars to the Toronto Press. I think disapproving Napanee residents need to humble themselves and realize that your residents are not at risk offenders, nor are these dangerous psychopaths or predators. I think that if Napanee Council was doing their mandated duty to safeguard the well-being of the community they purport to represent, they'd quickly reassure the paranoid personalities within the neighborhood that both the Ontario justice system and the Ontario psychiatric institutions do not permit potentially psychopathic or criminally dangerous beings to live in residential group homes anywhere, period. Such neighborhood profit by further reflecting upon the truth that they have absolutely no idea whether themselves might end up benefiting from such a caring facility such as at some unknown juncture in the future. As far as local residents taunting and harassing vulnerable care recipients while outside of the community, my sentiment is, have they been charged under the law? Call the OPP and have them summoned to court for breaking Ontario statutes. As far as the neighbor's speculative pronouncements that homes are becoming almost unsellable, this is nothing more than a thinly disguised form of unsubstantiated and prejudicial rattling. And to those who tout of upper class values, dare I shatter your illusions by suggesting that you are far from upper class. If you poke your heads up from your Napanee gopher holes and have a look around in 2012 or read the census, where you can fathom the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, dare I imagine that such bigots think of the lower middle class, or heaven forbid, we are the working poor. Some of these people reportedly even attend churches in your neighborhood, but have seemed to consistently miss the point. I am not a lawyer, but from past planning board experience, coupled with university training, I believe that if the town of Napanee wishes for you to locate, then they're the ones that ultimately should cover all your costs for a relocation. Nor can any council or its agency revoke a license, having had an opportunity to do so before approval, to my knowledge, at least not without becoming liable for damages. May peace be with you and yours. So that was really quite an inspiration starting my day today.
And you need those when you're in the middle of one of these firestorms.
Yeah,
and go ahead.
And we're getting them from all over the province. I've had people tell me that they've read the story in Texas. I've had emails from people in Texas. I've had people email me. I had somebody email me a couple of days ago and said, we have a planned vacation in September in Napanee, and I want to assure you that we want to help your residents and we want to support you, so we're canceling the trip to Napanee until this is settled. So this issue is just gone viral. People are so upset with what has happened here, and it never should have happened. You know, the town's lawyers gave them advice. They said they're legal. Don't pursue them. You will lose, yet they still pursue us. And why? Why pursue 7 disabled people? Why pursue me? I'm only the person who's trying to make a life for these people, some kind of a life they've never had, and clearly a life they want to live. You don't hear any families complaining about care here. You don't hear any families saying they've ever come to this house and found it unattended, which are some of the allegations. We have PSWs in here 3 times a day. We have doctors in here. We have nurses coming and going from here. We have occupational therapists. We have physiotherapists. All of these professionals in and out of this home every day. Not one of them would ever say the care here isn't superb. The clients aren't happy. I had a doctor call me the other day. He said, one of your patients, Kendra, he goes, I want to be supportive to you. I want to tell you this. One of your patients I've had since he is a young boy. And he said, he then developed schizophrenia. He said, he's been very sick for a long time. and he said, he is the best I've ever seen him in his whole life. And I can tell you, that's not the first physician that we've had tell us that. Almost every time we take the clients to the doctors, they always say, I've never seen them look better. They look so good. Like, they don't even look like the same people. Because they're showering regularly, you know. Their hair is done. Their hair is cut. You know, they take pride in themselves now. As soon as they start getting, you know, their hair looking a little bit long, I had one the other day, and he said, I'm going to have to get a haircut because I'm starting to look like an old hound. And before, they didn't care what they looked like. They didn't care if they showered when they first came. They didn't care if they were wearing clean clothes. They now have clean clothes. They have nice clothes. You know, we'll take them out shopping. We ask friends and family, like, donate clothes to us so that these people aren't wearing, you know, clothes that are too small or way too big or wild colors, because that's all that, you know, have been turned into places where, you know, they could access clothing. And, you know, they look like you or I.
Yeah.
It's not like they're wandering around the neighborhood looking, you know, disheveled. And they look like everyone else. And they deserve to be treated like everyone else.
Well, I'm a human rights specialist, and I can tell you, in my opinion, you have an absolute rock-tight case. And, commissioner of the Human Rights Commission has already come out saying that you've got a pretty good case here. So I believe that you'll find that the town is going to back down from their untenable position, and you will be able to live a happy existence there. And you know, I wish you all of the best
with all of
that. I mean, your mission statement is to put the home back in group home, and I believe that you're doing exactly that. And
yeah.
You know, hopefully all of the media attention is going to support you in doing exactly that with your clients. But unfortunately, we're out of time, Kendra, and we wish you all of the best here from
Thank
the team
so
at
much.
Between the Margins.
Thanks for having us on and helping to get the message out there.
No problem. So this has been Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce, and the rest of the team will be back in 2 weeks. And catch me on tomorrow, 3:30 to 6:30, doing a music show. And besides that, hope you find your happily ever after, whatever that may look like to you.